Okay, good morning. I'm State Representative Dave Pinto, the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division, and I'm calling this meeting of the division to order. I'd like to welcome everyone. We're being watched by folks via the House website and Facebook, et cetera. This is an informational hearing on two proposals to address the impact of COVID-19 on childcare. And this meeting is being held pursuant to House Rule 10.01. I'd like to remind folks, we have a number of people who are on a Zoom call that's then being broadcast to the public to keep yourself muted when you're not speaking. There's a raise hand feature you can use, or you can press *9 on your phone to request to speak. And to note for everyone that the meeting materials have been sent to members and staff that have also been posted to our website, at the House website, and so invite members of the public to check that out and get the information there. And we're going to start as usual with the roll call. I'm going to ask members to unmute. We may be able to do that automatically or just to choose to do that yourselves. And I'll ask our committee legislative assistant to call the roll now.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Katiza Watun, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative, yep. Thank you. Yep. Representative Bonner?
Present.
Representative Damath?
Present.
Representative Heintzman?
I'm here.
Representative Morrison?
Present.
Representative Pryor? Representative Pryor? Representative Wasilek?
Present.
Representative West.
Here.
Okay, so there is a quorum present. And so I'm going to provide a few opening comments and then just kind of our layout for the layout things for our hearing. So just to remind this, members presumably don't need this reminder at all, but for any members of the public who may have missed some of our earlier meetings, early care and learning was in financial crisis even before the pandemic. Just a critical sector for our economy and for our society and for all of us, and had the societal good borne on the backs of parents who are paying a big percentage of their income and providers taking very low wages. And of course, the pandemic has only made things worse. And we've had a number of hearings earlier in the summer, et cetera, on that as well. And we've done a lot this year to help members. We moved very quickly as the first state in the country to get emergency support to providers. And then that state funding that we approved in the first couple months of the pandemic, then was followed by some federal funding that's been going out to providers every month since then through a series of grants. And members, that funding is now due to end on December 31st. And if you think about then what comes after that, I personally really shudder to imagine that. We need to keep our critical childcare providers open to continue providing care, especially for essential workers. And I'll just note, and you have a letter in your packet from the Minnesota Hospital Association saying that one of their top reasons for staffing shortages is childcare. And then also just access, keeping providers open, is of course only half of the equation in this emergency. The other half is affordability, making sure that low-income families, many of whom are essential workers, can receive assistance in paying for this care as well. And many are on the waiting list and have been. This, in my view, members, is not a time for folks who are working in low-income jobs and which are essential jobs, long-term care, working in hospitals or grocery stores, gas stations, keeping things going. This is not a time to have those folks be then continuing to be on the waiting list. And of course, getting funding for their child care will boost our critical child care providers even more. So this is a hearing today to review proposals to address both of those issues. So one is to continue the support that's been provided every month to keep our providers going beyond December 31. And second, to get the lowest income working families off of that waiting list for childcare so they can fill those essential roles for the rest of us. So that's just a little bit of context for the purpose for this as we head into a special session on Monday, as members are well aware. So here's the plan for the hearing. We're gonna hear an overview of both proposals from representative of the administration, Ms. Hogenson from the Children's Cabinet. We're gonna have our House research staff just walk us through the details of the proposals. And then we're gonna have testifiers on both of these proposals. And then of course, we'll move to broader questions and discussion. I would ask Members, if you have clarifying questions during this initial testimony, of course, feel free to ask. But otherwise, if it's kind of more substantive stuff, more discussion, as we've often done, I'll ask that we hold that to the end and then we can have certainly a full discussion of questions and otherwise. So I'm just going to pause. If anybody has a question about the plan for this morning, please speak on up. I know folks won't be shy by doing that. But then otherwise, we're going to move to call Stephanie Hogenson from the Minnesota Children's Cabinet to join us. And as she does, and as she unmutes, I just want to note to members that the Children's Cabinet, Ms. Hogenson, I think that the Assistant Commissioner and Bailey's on the line as well, have done just heroic work this year in working with both a huge array of issues related to childcare and then really relating to Minnesota's kids more generally. And so I personally am just really grateful to them for their work and to Ms. Hogenson. And so I'll turn things to you to give us an overview of these two proposals.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Hogenson and I'm the Policy Director for the Children's Cabinet. And I will start with the Public Health Support Funds Bill 7SS AM 006. And if I understand there's a testifier who has a time constraint, so jump in if you need me to pause after I do the overview of that bill before jumping to the next one. The Children's Cabinet is housed within Minnesota Management and Budget and is an interagency partnership the governor has charged with helping make Minnesota the best place for each and every child to grow up. In COVID response, the Children's Cabinet has co-led, along with Deputy Commissioner Heather Mueller at MDE, the Education and Childcare Workgroup. This team is charged with coordinating the administration's cross-agency emergency response related to education and childcare, working toward the goals of ensuring the care of children does not inhibit critical workers from reporting to work, and continuity of education through the Safe Learning Plan, beginning with early education and childcare. Throughout the pandemic, the workgroup has engaged childcare providers and stakeholders to determine how to best support them to remain operating and serving children safely. So we have the workforce and our emergency response and economic recovery, and most importantly, so children have a safe, stable place where they can learn, grow, and thrive amidst the incredible challenges surrounding them, disrupting nearly all aspects of their young lives. This includes building strategies and efforts to match workers who experience changes in care needs directly with open, operating, licensed, or certified providers. In terms of financial and other support, Minnesota has allocated approximately $188 million in a combination of mostly federal and some state aid to support the childcare industry and access for families, including for childcare financial support, critical care supplies, increased access to school-age care for low-income families, and administrative flexibilities to support providers and care access. While a critical sector for our emergency response, the industry faces significant ongoing increased costs, given the requirements needed to safely provide childcare in the midst of a global pandemic. And they're not able to meet these costs without support. Before doing a walkthrough of the bills, I do want to take just a moment to thank the childcare providers and childcare workforce across our state that have been caring for our children, risking their own exposure to the virus since the beginning of the pandemic, many who are probably on this call. They are the heroes that allow all our emergency workers to do their jobs in their response efforts by showing up every day for our children and families, and really for all of us. We can't thank them enough. The first bill I'll provide an overview for is, as I mentioned, 7SS-AM-006, Public Health Support Funds for Childcare. The bill extends the public health support funds that end in December to help childcare providers operate safely during the COVID-19 pandemic, given state and federal public health guidance. These funds are needed to ensure childcare providers can remain operating and filling our economic recovery and the lives and the development of our children. The extension continues the COVID-19 Public Health Support Fund for Childcare program that began in July and has helped more than 8,300 licensed and certified providers remain operating and meeting these increased costs. The amounts allocated by provider type and the program design of the Public Health Support Funds were created with input from researchers, legislators, childcare providers, and childcare stakeholders. These funds allow childcare providers that are operating and serving children to support higher costs related to the guidance, which include creating smaller and more consistent childcare groupings, following screening procedures, quarantine periods, and temporary closures related to the to public health guidance, increased cleaning and sanitation costs, increased staffing costs like sick leave, substitute teachers, incentive pay, overtime, and providing supports for distance learning, as well as other public health measures that prevent the transmission of COVID-19. The Public Health Support Fund used $110 million from the Federal Coronavirus Relief Fund, or the CRF, to fund monthly payments to all operating and eligible providers July to December. We want to thank legislators across the House and Senate for their feedback on this program and collaboration over the past several months. These funds were approved by the Legislative Advisory Commission and included $56.6 million in CRF funding July to September and $53.3 million for the October to December funding period in place right now. All eligible childcare providers who applied and met the requirements received monthly payments. This was $1,200 for licensed family childcare providers, $8,500 for licensed centers. In July and August, nonprofit certified centers received $8,500. And in October to December, certified centers will receive $3,000 per month. The December payments currently will be reduced based on the available funding and the number of eligible providers. Despite historic investments in our state's child care programs, the resources are finite. We received more applications than anticipated, and the request for funds was more than available. And unless this bill passes, licensed providers will receive a reduced payment up to about 55% at a time when any hope of additional funding is uncertain. In total, about 7,044 programs received payments from July to September. 8,364 programs received payments in the first 2 months of the October to December payment period. This includes 6,316 licensed family child care providers, 1,536 licensed childcare centers, and 512 certified centers. And an outline of that information, I believe, is available in a handout. Of the 9,600 licensed programs in Minnesota, approximately 87% received at least one payment. And many providers have shared that the receipt of these funds has made the difference in their ability to stay open. And really, Minnesota's childcare providers have stepped up and have remained open, unlike some other states. The U.S. Department of Human Services Office of Inspector General did an analysis on child care providers and how they're operating across the state using CCDF lead agencies' information. And they found that many states had upwards of 60 to 75% closures as of April 30th. Minnesota, in that survey, was one of nine states where fewer than 25% of their programs were operating. And currently, to give you a picture of how many of our providers are operating, I'll summarize some data from the Department of Human Services Licensing Division. The percentage of family childcare and childcare center licenses that were operating dropped significantly at the beginning of the pandemic during the stay-at-home period, but has returned to nearly 100% over the last 8 months. The capacity is needed as many programs are running with smaller group sizes and other changes. Both openings and closings have slowed for family child care programs and child care centers during the pandemic compared to the same month in 2019. As a result, the net decrease of family child care providers has been lower in the first 11 months of 2020 compared to the first 11 months of 2019. So in 2020, we saw a net loss of 281 providers, and in 2019, a net loss of 379 providers. However, this does not have a significant impact on the very long year-over-year trend that shows a decrease in the number of family child care providers in our state and a trend that is shown nationally. Child care center providers, licensed child care centers, have seen almost the exact same net change in 2020 versus 2019. So 2020 saw a net gain of 28 providers, 2019, 27 providers in the first 11 months. So In summary of that data, the pandemic does not seem to have had an impact on the proportion on our licensed capacity in our state, unlike many other states. And this is an indication that our supports are working. The childcare industry is made up of small businesses. The majority of our providers are family childcare providers, and the majority of our centers, around 70%, are single centers. not chain centers. They have been asked to stay open to provide care for our children and face increased costs, and these funds would support them in continuing to stay open at that level. And they've experienced extreme stress and without additional support are likely to close. A survey from the National Association of the Education for Young Children did show that about 34% of them are certain that without additional public assistance, they will close permanently. And 92% are paying more for cleaning supplies, 68% for critical care supplies, and 52% for staff and other costs. Another study showed that more than half are using their credit card to cover expenses. So in sum, if continued public health supports are not made available to keep childcare programs in Minnesota open, we fear that childcare deserts will worsen, especially in low-income and rural communities. We faced a childcare crisis in our state before the pandemic, particularly in rural areas. If we don't continue investing in our childcare industry, we won't have the access to care we need for our emergency response, and it will disproportionately impact healthcare worker families, other emergency workers, and families of color and American Indian children. And ultimately, it will impact all of Minnesotans. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to pause there and see where we're at time-wise.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Oginson. I do want to note Representative Pryor has joined us. So welcome, Representative Pryor, which I think completes our team here. So all the members are on this call. Hello. And you're right, we do have a testifier who will need to leave. I think we've got a little bit of time, though. So maybe we'll have Ms. Mock walk us through just to understand the technical aspects of the one provision, and we'll see how we do on the second one. And we can keep things kind of focused and tight. So, and I do before, Ms. Mott, before you start that, I just want to note again for members of the public that all of the documents being referenced are on our early childhood website, including a couple of their labeled DHS handouts that kind of summarize each of these two provisions, but a number of other pieces as well. So direct folks' attention there. But Ms. Mock, if you can walk us through this first proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This proposal, we're looking at 7SS-AM006. This proposal would appropriate $53.1 million from the general fund to DHS for the additional support funds that Ms. Hoganson described. Excuse me. These are monthly funds that would go to child care providers that would be available this month in December and January, February of next year. The types of providers who would be eligible for these funds are family child care providers, child care centers, and certified license exempt child care centers. These eligible providers would have to comply with a number of requirements in order to receive the funds, including having had applied for the October support funds that Ms. Hoganson described. And they would also have to agree to stay open and serve children through February 15th, 2021, with some exceptions for disruptions due to public health guidance and temporary planned closures like vacations. The maximum amount that a provider could receive under this proposal varies by provider types. Family child care providers could receive no more than $1,200 each month, including any funds that they would receive in December from the federal support funds. Child care centers would receive no more than $8,500 each month, again, including the money that they would receive in December from the federal support funds. And certified license exempt centers would not receive any additional funds under this proposal in December, but they could receive up to $3,000 in each of January and February. Under this proposal, the appropriation is available until June 30th, 2020, or until 60 days after the peacetime emergency ends, whichever occurs earlier.
Thank you, Ms. Mock. So again, members will have time for questions, further questions and discussion later, but if there's any clarifying question about anything on this, let me know. And again, we can also do clarification later. Otherwise, I do think it probably does make sense to have, we have one testifier that does need to leave pretty shortly. So what I wanna do is we'll have that testifier go, and then we'll go back to Ms. Hoganson and Ms. Mock again to discuss the second proposal. And that testifier is Ms. Bromberg. And so if you can, I can see you've unmuted. And so please introduce yourself, identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed.
Okay. My name is Ariane Bromberg, and I'm a family child care provider in Rochester, Minnesota. Good morning, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. My name is Ariane Bromberg, and I'm a family child care provider in Rochester, Minnesota. I'm a three-star parent aware provider with over 25 years of experience. I care for eight children whose parents all work for Mayo Clinic and are directly involved in COVID care and response. The families I serve are transplants to Rochester without extended family here to assist with childcare. Throughout my career, I have served on various childcare committees, boards, and even been involved in the legislation process for the childcare field. I'm currently serving on the Family Childcare Task Force. I bring a unique perspective to this pandemic, not only as a provider, but also from my personal life. I'm a mom of three grown sons, a grandma to an 18-month-old granddaughter who lives in rural Minnesota and attends a family child care program. Her father, my oldest son, is a deputy sheriff for Mille Lacs County, and his wife is an essential worker for Sherburne County. My husband is the emergency manager for Olmsted County. I have had a front row seat to this pandemic from day one and been able to see this through many different lenses. Provider, parent, community member, spouse, mother of a frontline worker. So many of our families in Minnesota have been affected by the pandemic. Job loss, pay cut, furloughs, change in employment hours. With all of my families connected to Mayo, I have seen this firsthand. I know that I am speaking for many providers when I support the CCAP investment considered in this package. It would help every part of our economy and generate revenue stability for our providers. Furthermore, I would like to talk about the direct financial supports that have been given to childcare providers. Many providers have lost families or chose to reduce the number of children in our care to reduce our rate of exposure, which means a loss of income for us. I have been fortunate to receive the childcare public health grants since July. My operational costs from cleaning supplies have increased, the cleaning hours using them, utility costs associated with the increased cleaning, groceries, healthcare supplies, and don't get me started on the 4 thermometers I had to buy just to take the children's temps. I know many providers that have closed down anywhere from 14 to 24 days because of a COVID exposure or a household member has COVID themselves. Losing 2 to 4 weeks of income for anyone is a huge burden. Imagine a second or third shutdown and the financial impact to a provider. I am afraid many of them won't reopen if this happens and they will find employment elsewhere. The grants have helped assist me and my fellow providers through parents' furloughs, pay cuts from their employer, and unforeseen closures. It gives providers the cash flow to still meet their financial obligations for when we have to be shut down due to a COVID exposure. During the unprecedented time, child care providers have been unwavering in their care while facing the unknown. Minnesota child care providers are key components to the state's economy. Without them, many employees cannot report for work. Our state desperately needs a stable environment for providers so we may provide quality care and learning opportunities to the youngest Minnesota citizens. In my 25 years as a provider, I am needed now more than ever. Childcare is a constant in many children's lives we serve, and for my various roles as a provider, mother, spouse, community member, I have seen firsthand the virus impact it's had on each of our lives and the importance of the financial supports given to the providers during these uncharted times. I appreciate your consideration and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Bromberg. Representative Heintzman had a question before Ms. Bromberg spoke. I'm going to go to him in just a second, but just if anybody has, before Ms. Bromberg has to leave, anybody has any questions for her, please raise your hand and let us know. We'll just keep an eye on that just for a second. And then I don't believe that we do. I'm just going to check with staff. It's a little more challenging with the virtual hearings here. But I believe that we have that. So Ms. Bromberg, when you need to hop off, please do. Thank you so much for all of your work and for your testimony too.
Thank you.
Really very much appreciate that. And then we're gonna go, and my apologies, Representative Heintzman, for not realizing the hand was raised before Ms. Bromberg spoke, but sounds like you have a clarifying question otherwise, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Ms. Bromberg, for your testimony. My question was for the previous testifier going through some of the ins and outs of the bill, and clarification that I was hoping for was relative to those that would be potentially eligible. And my understanding based on her testimony was that if you haven't already applied for assistance, which I'm sure many people have, but those that may not have, it sounds like they wouldn't be eligible to apply now. Is that correct?
So Ms. Hoganson, let's have you talk about that if we can.
Yes, so the bill does extend the public health support funds to the current recipients and would not initiate a new application period for new providers. As I mentioned in my testimony, about 87% of our licensed and certified providers have received the public health support, so they've reached a high number of our providers.
Representative Heitzman.
Mr. Chair, I would just maybe ask that those negotiating this, talking about this bill, working on the language over the next few weeks, potentially consider an option for those that may not have already applied. It's just something to maybe be thinking about. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Representative Heitzman. Maybe I'll just ask Ms. Hoganson if you have, Assistant Commissioner Bailey's on the line as well, if there's any comment about that point. That you want to make at this point at all, this in terms of the reason to restrict it simply to those that have been receiving it previously versus the idea of expanding beyond. Just any thoughts in reaction to Representative Heitzman's point? Look for, sorry, Ms. Bailey, if you can identify yourself for the record, Commissioner Bailey.
Sure, this is Erin Bailey. I serve as the Executive Director of the Governor's Children's Cabinet and co-lead of the work group. It's a great question. I think it is certainly something that we could be open to in those discussions. The reason why it's structured in the way that it is one, we have sort of had a value to not incentivize providers to come online, but to support those providers who have been providing the emergency services and care. And two, just administratively, to create less burden for the providers and for the process to keep the kind of costs lower in terms of the administration and just not really open an additional application process. And I would say a huge thank you to the DHS leaders on the line here, and they should add anything else that they want to, because they really built a process where those applications were pre-populated and were reaching out and making it as easy on the providers as possible. To support them during this difficult time.
And I guess I'd encourage, I'd certainly encourage that if this be something we continue to look at, and because it is, we want to be providing as much support as we can. Representative Franson, I know, had a question. Representative Franson.
Thank you. Can you hear me, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay.
Yep.
So I would just piggyback off of Representative Heitzman, and I'm glad to hear that there is some openness to expand. I think we're hearing from our constituents, I know for sure I am, that children are being left home alone. I spoke to a mom, messaged with a mom this week, a 9-year-old child. They have nowhere to bring that child during the day because they're both not, neither one of them are tier one employees, right? And so they're leaving that 9-year-old home alone during the day while the child still has to go to school via virtual learning. And that mom is just in a wreck because obviously she doesn't want to leave her 9-year-old son, but there's nowhere to bring these children, Mr. Chair. And yes, we don't want to incentivize, but at the same time, maybe we kind of do right now during this time. We don't want children being left home alone. We certainly don't want an accident that happens and then, you know, that parent points the finger to the legislature for making it impossible for a safe place to be found for those children.
Thank you, Reverend Spranson. I guess that maybe raises just a clarifying question for me then, is that if and as we would add more providers, what might that do to the cost of the proposal? So this is costed out of the $53 million to continue the program that's been running the last number of months. If we bring in more providers, do we have a sense of sort of if we add X number of providers, the cost would increase to some? Can you just sort of talk about how that might work from a cost perspective? And I guess we've got, not sure who would feel comfortable answering. I see Commissioner Bailey.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I think the the question would be about additional appropriations needed to meet the additional providers. We could, I think, do the analysis of if we received, if an additional number, what that would look like, or it would require scaling in on the other pieces. And I just would also say it would also require additional administrative costs in reopening and running an additional grant process as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Bailey. Any other clarifying questions right now? And of course, we'll be able to circle back to this later, but I think it is useful since we have two proposals to kind of get into some of the details of this first proposal. Any other clarifying questions anybody has right now? Not being aware of, Representative Damuth. Again, it's a little bit challenging with the virtual setup. So Representative Damuth, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that the bill language talks about grant amounts up to. How are those being scaled? What is the criteria being used? Maybe for Ms. Hoganson?
Ms. Hoganson, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Damuth. Because we received more applications than anticipated and did not have enough funds, we saw more providers apply and meet the operating requirements in December. The plan is to scale those payments up to 55% for both licensed family child care providers and licensed child care centers. We do plan to keep the certified center payment at $3,000 in December, which was their payment in October and November, because it was already a reduced payment amount. And so that is the bill would fill that gap and bring them back up to that $8,500 for centers, $1,200 for family child care. And I think the language around up to is what we have used, just because in the modeling we did to estimate how many are operating and available, you know, we wanted to be understand that, do a good estimate to ensure that we're able to provide to all open and operating providers who are eligible. That was a piece of feedback we really heard loud and clear after the peacetime emergency grants, that we could lower the payment amount some to serve all eligible providers.
Representative Damon, follow-up?
No follow-up. Thank you, Ms. Hoganson. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And then Representative Franson, I believe, had a follow-up question.
No, Mr. Chair, I'm okay. Thank you.
Okay, misunderstood. Okay, so then anyone else? Just looking here. Okay, I think we're ready then to move on to the second proposal. And so, Ms. Hoganson, if you can give us a brief overview of that, and then again, we'll have Ms. Mock walk us through the language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll now provide an overview of 7SS-AM009, which makes an investment in the Basic Sliding Fee Child Care Assistance Program to provide access and affordability to child care for lower-income working families, most of whom are essential workers and who need affordable child care now. Child care affordability and availability are intertwined components of child care access for families. The previous bill supports providers in remaining open and providing access to care. This bill supports access and affordability to families to provide supports to care access for lower income essential workers. Both access and affordability, as this committee very well knows, were at a crisis before the pandemic. This has been exacerbated with the pandemic, especially for lower wage earning essential worker families in healthcare, public health, education, and other sectors. Each day, we are hearing more about and urgently connecting families with care needs to available providers, as well as working with employers with staffing concerns related to childcare, including hospitals and other critical facilities, as I believe the chair mentioned at the beginning. We are also working with legislators to address these concerns and these access concerns they're hearing from constituents. These are urgent needs where the pandemic has disrupted access and affordability. An elder relative who can no longer care for a child, a healthcare worker who has to pick up extra shifts due to staffing shortages, or a nursing assistant in a nursing home whose child school shifted to distance learning. So this bill aims to support some of these families quickly and efficiently by adding $11.5 million in state general funds appropriated to the basic sliding fee portion of the child care assistance program. Beginning in 2021, an estimated 570 new families could be served. To meet the needs of the pandemic, this supports families in critical sectors. It's estimated about 82% of families eligible for child care assistance are essential workers. This bill directs funds to counties with waiting lists. Based on October data, at least 17 counties, including 10 non-metro and 7 metro, would be positioned to serve new families. This bill also supports the child care industry to fill open slots. Families can choose centers, licensed family child care, or legal non-licensed caregivers, and about 4,000 providers across the state are registered to receive child care assistance payments. To achieve the goal of reaching families who are not served quickly and efficiently, waitlist priority categories and statute temporarily change in this bill, as outlined in Section 2. This reprioritization of the waitlist is an idea brought forward by counties to more efficiently manage the waitlist and quickly serve more families without access. This proposal would bypass transition year extension and portability pool families who currently get child care assistance just through April 2021. Those families usually move into basic sliding fee when funds are available. Under this proposal, they continue to be served using MCHIP forecasted funds, child care funds. Counties and tribes manage their spending to protect commitments made each calendar year. Typically, families are added at the start of the calendar year, and counties and tribes closely monitor their availability of funds. This addition of one-time funding with temporary reprioritization language early in 2021 allows funds to flow at the right time and provides sufficient amount of time for counties and tribes to plan accordingly for their calendar year 2022 potential commitments. If this bill passes, DHS will publish new basic sliding fee allocations for calendar year 2021, and counties can begin to reach families soon. Much of the current need is met by this investment. Of the estimated 1,500 families not being served based on October waiting list, it is expected that about one-third will apply in a timely manner and be determined eligible. So the goal of this funding is to provide the funding and reprioritization tool to make it very possible that waiting lists would be temporarily eliminated, so at least for a short time in 2021. The bill would mean critical workers in hospitals, nursing facilities, and other low-wage industries, including those impacted by job and wage loss related to the pandemic, so working families, an opportunity to access affordable care at a time when there are so many seeking support to find care that meets their needs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Hoganson, thank you. We'll have Ms. Mock walk us through the language of the proposal and then again move to clarifying questions. Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this proposal appropriates a total of $11.5 million from the general fund to DHS to address the basic sliding fee child care assistance waiting list. The proposal addresses the waiting list in a few different ways. First, it appropriates $9.98 million to DHS for the BSF program. This appropriation is in Subdivision 1, starting on line 1.6. This money would be used to increase the number of families who move from the waiting list to the actual receiving assistance under the program. Second, the proposal would make temporary changes to eligibility for BSF child care assistance. This is in Subdivision 2, starting on line 1.16. These changes would be in effect for 4 months, January through April of 2021. One of these changes is to allow counties to let families maintain a spot on the waiting list, even if the family does not currently need childcare. And the other changes relate to the eligibility priorities for the basic sliding fee program. So under current law, eligibility for BSF is prioritized for certain families, and this proposal would make changes to those priorities. The change that I'm going to draw your attention to relates to the second appropriation in the bill. That's starting on line 1.13. This is for $1.52 million to DHS. And this relates to the transition year extension families that Ms. Hoganson mentioned. So these families would be moved from the second priority group where they are under current law down to the fourth priority group under this proposal. So by dropping these families down in the priority list, it's expected that they'll continue to receive MFIP child care assistance for a longer period of time. And the $1.52 million then is for the extended time that they're on the MFIP child care assistance. And this proposal will be effective January 1st of 2021.
Thank you, Ms. Mock. Clarifying questions regarding this proposal. Again, after this, we'll go to testifiers and then we'll certainly have a full opportunity for full questions and discussion. But questions that folks have, and I see Representative Bonner has a question. Representative Bonner.
Yes, thank you. Actually, I have two. The first one is probably a quick one, but I know we very quickly covered the number of new families that could be helped by this particular program. Could you repeat that number for me quick?
Ms. Hoganson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonner, it's estimated 575 new families could be served by this proposal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hoganson, the second question is, you know, in terms of trying to assess the need and how we could kind of fill the gaps, I guess I'm curious a little bit on how we determined what that amount was for the aid, and if you think that it's adequate. I mean, is it going to be enough, I guess, is sort of my second question.
Ms. Hoganson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonner, the way we got to the dollar amount was really based on that, the response rate of the waiting list. And so based on how counties do wait list release, about a third of families I mentioned in my testimony end up responding to those in a timely manner and being determined eligible. And so that 575 is about one third of what the current wait list is. So it serves those families who are currently on the wait list. To your point about the need, the wait list is one number that gets at the need, but not all families who are eligible for child care assistance or could access the program are on a waiting list, even when there isn't sufficient funding to serve them. And I don't know if there's other DHS staff that would like to jump in on how the number was determined. But those are kind of a general response, Mr. Chair.
And I guess it's a little bit hard to see if there's other folks, staff that do want to jump in, as Ms. Hoganson referenced. Please, I guess, unmute yourself and you can start doing that. Otherwise, Representative Bonner, do you have a follow-up on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Hoganson. I think that somewhat answers my question. So a lot of that was determined based on looking at the existing wait list and how you could fulfill some of that piece. So I guess the short answer seems like in terms of is it enough? Perhaps not, but it's certainly a good step in helping fill some of the immediate demand. So I appreciate your response. Thank you.
I would just thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bonner. I would just add,
you know, the value was focused on an emergency response and immediate access. And so our recommendation has been to not go higher in a sense where there would be potentially unused dollars. The proposal is scalable. We would just not recommend scaling higher, as we would not want to be in a situation where there would be money for an emergency response that would be unused, if that makes sense.
Okay. Representative Bonner, anything further from you then?
Yeah, just lastly, you know, thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Bailey. I certainly do appreciate the thoughtfulness in terms of where we put our resources in the midst of an emergency and considering our budget, you know, considerations as well. I certainly appreciate the desire to be thoughtful about how we spend those dollars. The question we always have in this committee is, can we do enough? How do we do enough? And I know that we all obviously feel very passionately about our earliest learners in this committee. Without a doubt, that is not limited to one side of the aisle or one agency. I think we're all united in that. So, you know, I'm grateful for you thinking through that and what that looks like and being conscious of the fact that we do have to be careful about our financial choices right now, but still be able to try and help as many families as we can. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bonner. Thank you, Representative Bonner, pardon me. Representative Heintzman, as up next, did it relate to the previous, the provider support bill, Representative Heintzman, or was it relating to this?
You know, Mr. Chair, I think the question actually could affect or be affected relevant to both questions or both.
Sure, bills. Please.
Maybe Commissioner Bailey had some more insight on this, but I'm hearing, you know, some conversation about the costs and so on and so forth. I'm glad we're talking about that because obviously coming into a projected deficit, you know, there's a lot of concern there relative to what we're spending now because we'd have to find cuts later potentially. So I am wondering, Commissioner Bailey, maybe if these bills move forward, are they, would they potentially be compliant and allow for federal funds to reimburse?
Well, we may have lost the very end of your question, Representative Heintzman. You may be
sorry
muted
about that, Mr. Literally. Chair.
That's okay.
Sorry about that, Mr. Chair. I was just asking if the funds could potentially be if federal funds could potentially reimburse the general fund for the cost of these two proposals.
Good, thank you. And Commissioner Bailey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Heintzman. I want to defer to, I think Dave Greenman, the budget director of DHS, is on here too. And it would be a question, I think, about what if the legislation would need to say that explicitly, and then what the exactly what the federal government comes through with. Sort of there's kind of a fluctuation in terms of what those conversations look like. We highly believe there will be additional federal resources for this and kind of vast agreement on that at a national level. But those would be the two pieces. And I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you're comfortable with Dave or someone else from DHS speaking up as well.
And Commissioner, I'm just fine with Mr. Greenman doing that, though I'm not certain that he is in fact on. Maybe I'll ask somebody from DHS who may be able to provide insights to unmute yourself and identify yourself for the record and see if you can give us an answer, if there is somebody who can do that. I see Ms. Sommerfeld, perhaps.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Chair. Okay. Dave Greenman is not on this call, and I'm not the financial expert, but I think that that would be possible. This is how the discussion has gone that I'm aware of. But I think it would potentially be necessary to have some language in the bill itself to say that we could backfill with federal funds should they come forward. But I think that certainly is something we're open to talking about.
And Ms. Sommerfeld, if you can just, let me just have Ms. Sommerfeld identify herself for the record.
Pardon me. I'm sorry.
It's your role. That's okay.
It's Zoom, you know, I forget that this is, I'm Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm the Legislative Director for Children and Family Services at DHS.
Okay, and we may want to have you connect with Mr. Greenman, but let's go back to Representative Heintzman. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that if it is important that that would be included in the bill to make sure that those federal funds could reimburse the general fund, it would make sense to be seriously considering that. So I'm glad we're talking about it. Thank you for letting me ask the question.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Heintzman. And I may even ask Ms. Sommerfeld, since we're going to have some testifiers in discussion, I mean, it may even be that we can get just a little bit of insight even, and this may not be possible, no problem if not, but even if in the next, you know, 20 minutes, we have just a little more insight that somebody gets, then certainly feel free to speak up. But otherwise, we'll figure that after this hearing, if we can get some information on Representative Heintzman's question and line of questioning, that'd be really helpful. So good.
Great.
Thank
I'll
you.
Reach out to some of our budget folks to see if I can get an answer.
Ms. Sommerfeld, thank you for that. Thank you. Other clarifying question. I'm just looking to see if we're all set. Hold on, everybody, as I'm checking, connecting. Okay, so I know we have another testifier who needs to leave very quickly. So we're going to go to Ms. Jaquith. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, your last name. If you can please identify yourself for the record and provide your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Kristen Jaquith. I operate 2 4-star rated centers in Litchfield and Wilmer. We've been in business this year for 22 years. We serve families that work in over 100 businesses in Meeker and Candelia counties. Right now, the stress of COVID-related quarantines and illnesses are devastating in our child care centers. Just wanted to kind of give you guys a walk in my shoes to understand how desperate our situation is right now. On Monday, my day started at 3 a.m. with texts from staff and parents about COVID-related illness and exposure. That day ended up at the center until after 6:30 p.m. I had 5 staff that were out. It was almost uncoverable. We were at absolute bare minimum for staffing, and we still are today. I've had to move children into different classrooms to keep us in ratio. The stress of covering the staffing in multiple rooms is beyond a stress at this point. This isn't providing high quality childcare anymore. We're just trying to survive. And in our business, we value keeping our ratios low and our quality high. I had to send out a notice to my families this week stating that we may have to close for short notice because we simply don't have the staff to keep our doors open at this point. It's not only devastating these families, but our community and the businesses that they work for. I have hospital, clinic, nursing home staff, teachers, police force, retail, service industry, and manufacturing employees that we care for their children. We've used the funding that we've received to cover the costs of closing our classrooms and a small hazard pay for our staffing. We've followed the governor's request of not charging when families have to leave for quarantine or COVID-related separations. It's not just one or two families that are not paying every week. It's 20 plus at a time, and it's devastating our bottom line. And without the grant supports continuing, we can't stay open. We won't make it through the next 3 months like this. Our payroll and operating expenses are far exceeding our revenues at this point. The supports have helped us pay the operating costs. We're not making money off of them. They're barely helping us to get by. Without them, we would not be open at this point anymore. I won't be able to cover hazard pay for my staff after the funding ceases. It's just not going to be possible. When COVID first hit, as owners, we didn't take a paycheck for 2 months. I'm going to be back in that position shortly to make sure that my employees still get paid. It's not a burden that's been easy. It's been really hard. We have a very large number of families that utilize CCAP. Many of families that are waiting. These families would not be in the workforce without CCAP supports. And with extending those CCAP dollars, we'd be able to fund more families. The funding coming from CCAP is a stability funding for us. I know I can count on income from those families that are on it. Lately, I've had people ask me, why don't you just close your doors and walk away? I can't walk away from 50 employees. And I can't leave all these families without childcare. If we had to close, you're not losing just childcare. You're losing 22 years of expertise and in education, something you can't replace. And I want to thank you for listening. I hope I gave you a small glimpse of how desperate our situation is.
Ms. Jaquith, thank you for your for sharing your experience and for just the amazing work that you do. Your comments really affected me, and I think I speak for everybody on the committee when I say that. You do amazing work, and the people who are and those who join you around the state doing that work as well, and the ripple effects of what you do. You mentioned just a few of them. Of course, they go out all through our communities. We need you, and we want to be there to support you. Members, are there any clarifying questions or comments from Ms. Jaquith in particular?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Ms. Representative Katisa-Witun.
Thank you. Ms. Jaquith, I just wanted to extend my appreciation for the hard work that you are doing for these families and making sure that you're supporting your staff. You and the woman who shared her story earlier and all of our child care providers across the state found yourself in an impossible position. And I want to commend you for giving it your all. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Katisa-Witun. Just again, making sure in this virtual space, it can be a little bit challenging to see hands. Okay. I will just note the Representative Bonner, I know, thanks you, Ms. Jaquith, as well, for the courage to come and share your story expresses our gratitude, your service for our communities as well. Okay, not seeing other hands. So Ms. Jaquith, you can hop off whenever it works for you. Thank you so much for your work again and for your comments and for joining us today. We really appreciate it. We have members, I know another testifier, or a couple others. So why don't we go to Mr. Rademacher from Little Falls. I hope I'm saying your last name correctly.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You did. For the record, my name is John Rademacher. I'm the city administrator in Little Falls. Also a parent of a 2.5-year-old and 5-year-old who have dealt with a number of different childcare struggles and while both my wife and I were working. And I want to say thanks to Ms. Jaquith. I know, having been through the parent side of that, your work is incredible. You guys are heroes in our communities and really truly do serve us way more than anybody ever realizes, and your impact is really strong. And that's part of the reason I want to be here today and share some of my story and some of the things that we're trying to do in our community and advocate for, you know, these efforts to continue. And I know there's never going to be enough money. There's never going to be enough resources to hit everybody and serve everybody to the extent of providing high quality childcare throughout our state. But every little bit helps, and every opportunity that we have gets us one step closer to making that a reality for everywhere in the state, and especially in in greater Minnesota communities like ours and Ms. Jaquith's. When I came to Little Falls 5 years ago, I actually had to live apart from my family for about 3 months because we didn't have we didn't have access to childcare at all in our community, even though we were going from a smaller community to Little Falls, which is about 8,500 people. At that time, we did find solutions, and once we did, we had some stability in our lives regarding childcare with both my wife and I working. Unfortunately, with the pandemic, my wife was put in a position where she had a choice to stay employed or to stay home with our children, and which she did. And we're not regretting that decision, but we certainly are sympathetic to the childcare system that we left behind, because it was an awesome experience and amazing education for our children. As we move forward, I as an employer serving of 48 full-time staff that are across the board, very much critical and essential workers in our community. Access to childcare is incredibly important. We've had a number of different issues this year where our center and family childcare providers have had to temporarily close their doors or shut down, which has left us in real binds with the care and the abilities for our employees to be working. So any access that we can to keep those doors open is really important. We saw that right away. And prior to any assistance that was being able to be delivered out from the community, we worked with the Initiative Foundation, one of the six, one of the Minnesota investment funds in the state, and we're able to get out $20,000 to 13 of our family care providers, which led to two of them responding that without that assistance, and this was in April, without that assistance, they would have been closing their doors in May, which kept them open, which bridged their gap into these funds that now I'm sure they're accessing as well. This has been an issue for us. We've been working on this almost my entire time that I've spent in Little Falls. It has been a critical effort to helping us continue to grow in our community and improve our economy. We have had a number of a number of professionals that have contacted me, knew my story and knew my access to childcare struggles that I had early on, asking me for as much help as I could provide. I connected them with as many of the providers and the people that I knew that could possibly help, but I know stories that did exist where professionals weren't able to move into our community because they didn't have access to childcare. The same goes for essential workers in our hospitals and in our schools. They have had numerous struggles, and this has rippling effects not only on those families that are here, but those parents and grandparents of those essential workers that are also impacted when those folks can't go to work. I had that very instance with an employee of mine last month when her daughter-in-law, who worked at the local hospital, didn't have access to childcare temporarily due to a closure. And it really will potentially stymie the opportunities that we have to grow our economies and recover from this recession. So it comes to a question of priorities and what funds can do the things that we need to do to get everything back on track once this recession ends, and the pandemic ends, because it will, and we're trying to prepare ourselves in that front. And what we've just experienced here is that it really does come down to being able to finance childcare in a wide variety of different ways, not only on supporting the facilities, but also supporting the families through those assistance programs, because we are a community with a household medium income of $37,000, which is, you know, just adds to the struggles for those families to keep working and what they can, you know, the services that they can provide. So with that, I want to say thank you again to all those childcare providers that and the amazing work that they're doing. And thank you for the time to testify today.
Mr. Rademacher, thank you very much for your testimony and for your work. Any clarifying questions or anything for Mr. Rademacher from committee members? Again, I'll just pause just for a second here. Okay, and I'm not aware of any. Then I'm going to thank you very much again, and then you can hang on for as long as you'd like. And I'm going to turn to our final testifier, Ms. Richardson. Thank you so much for being here with us. If you could please identify yourself for the record once you unmute, and please share what you have to say.
Hi, nice to meet you. I'm Asia Richardson. I'm an essential worker. I work at a nursing home. So I work in the kitchen. So, and I'm the dietary concierge. So I'm in full contact with the residents. We have quite a bit of cases. And so we get tested every 2 weeks. Basically, I share, I go in the rooms with them, full mask, full gear, and basically get their likes and dislikes and what they, you know, enjoy and just everybody in the building. So,
Please, and please share your comments or your thoughts about these proposals.
I think that it's wonderful that this is happening, because I was on childcare. When I first tried to get on childcare, they told me I would have to wait 6 months, and that turned into 2 years, because after 6 months, I called them back and they told me that they accidentally forgot to put me on the waiting list. So then I had to wait another year. Well, they said it would be 6 months, but then it was another year. So I just got accepted September 21st, 2020. So that's great. But it was really hard, because everybody in my family, I'm a single mother, so everybody in my family is an essential worker. So they work at nursing homes or clinics, and they work, so it would be going out of their schedule. I had to find, I kind of just don't want anybody watching my son, just because he has, he's slightly autistic, and we're still going through that process of trying to find out the scales of autism he is. So it's just, I just don't trust a lot of people watching my child. So I had to make it work. I would have to, one day my mom would watch him or my dad, and then they would have to take off work until I got assistance. So that was great. And then I found the YMCA, which gave me assistance through the YMCA. That helped a little bit until my assistance actually kicked in. So I think it would be great that, I think what you guys are doing is great. Because when I first tried to sign up, they told me basically I make too much. I would have to make less than $1,000 just to get on childcare right away. And I would have to, And I would have to like get cash assistance as well, basically not work at all. In order to get it right away. But you know, people, I need to work in order to take care of my son and do all of those things. So it was pretty difficult for a little bit, but I kept my head high.
it's clear. Yeah. And it's good for the rest of us that you're working and taking care of our elders in our community. That is essential work.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you so much. That's really good. And thank you. And thank you for sharing your experience with us as well. And can I ask, you live in the St. Paul area, is that correct?
No, I work at Villa at St. Louis Park. That's what it's called.
But you live in the metro area, I guess, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Asking that.
In Minneapolis.
Okay, maybe. So I point that out to colleagues and to the members of the public as well, just that we've had testifiers from Wilmer, from Little Falls, from Rochester, and from the metro area as well, and just recognizing this really... this crisis has been impacting folks from all over the state, and so really appreciate that. Clarifying questions or really anything for Ms. Richardson here from members. And again, I'll kind of keep an eye on things. Just click. And again, really, really appreciate you you sharing your experience as a parent and doing such important work for our community. The folks, when you're going into their rooms and making sure that they're eating food that they like and that's nutritious for them and everything, that's really important for our elders.
You're right.
So thank you. Yeah, definitely. It sure is. Okay. Well, good. Well, I think we're all set. So, Ms. Richardson, thank you so much again for your testimony and your work. And you can feel free to hop off when it works for you. Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate
you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Take care. Okay.
Take care.
Bye. And members, before we move then to broader questions and discussion, I did want to point out that there are a number of letters of support or letters commenting on the proposals. I think they pretty much are all in support. There is one letter from MACSA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Agencies. I hope I'm saying that name right. That points out a couple of minor changes that they suggest. That I have to say, as I look at, makes sense. These are to the second provision we talked about, but certainly direct members' attention to that for consideration. Let's move then to broader questions and discussion. And any members, feel free. Representative Pryor, pardon me, and I may have missed you, Representative Pryor, if you had something for Ms. Richardson. Representative Pryor, we'll go to you first.
There we go. I'll try to make some brief comments because sometimes it gets noisy here. And I do have to say, just all of the testifiers here today, we so appreciate that you're able to do it. And, you know, it's one thing to note is probably many of them, the only reason they could be here is because we have this capacity for remote testimony. So thank you, Chair Pinto, and also our staff committee that makes this possible, and the technical people that behind the scenes that make all of this possible so that we can bring in these voices of people out there right now doing the work that they're doing, but also the families who this is life right now, being able to have safe, reliable childcare. And so just as a higher level, you know, we can kind of put this in the context of our committee. You know, we started last January and here we are in December, still having committee meetings, and we're still talking about the same issues. And what we've learned is so, you know, probably the urgency is even greater now. And what we know too is that these early childhood, you know, just to go back, our beginning introductory meetings, these months in the pandemic for these children is the most critical of anyone in the state right now. What they're missing or how they're able to survive and persevere in these months It means so much more to these earliest learners in their lives than it does for anybody else in the state. So just to say, we are, I mean, I think this is our highest priority right now, is to make sure these young children get through this pandemic in the strongest way possible, in the strongest way that we're able to support them. And that was true last year, those early months, and it's true this year in these months. Just, you know, to put that front and center on the committee again. And so, you know, I identify with the parents saying, this is, you know, I don't trust my child with anybody. And so that was true before the pandemic. It's true in the pandemic. It will be true after the pandemic. And the providers that just are, whatever sacrifice, they're there for us. And that was true before the pandemic. It's true during the pandemic. And it'll be true after the pandemic. And then this basic issue that we keep facing, which is the economics doesn't make sense. And that was true before. It's true now. It will be true after the pandemic. And we've got to make that, we've got to make the ends meet. We've got to figure out how to do that. And it's, I'm so glad that we've had this committee to know how, and this hearing in particular, to know how successful our work has been. Minnesota responded, and we put early childhood as one of the critical needs that we had to meet to face this pandemic. And from we heard from our testimony earlier, the data shows that this has been successful. That compared to other states, we lost fewer healthcare, fewer providers than other states did because we prioritized early childhood. And that, you know, we did our work and we showed, the data shows that we've been successful. So I just have to say, you know, what we're planning to do and to make this a priority again, there's such urgency behind it. And I think we just need to come out of this as one voice that this is the right thing to do. It's the smart thing to do. And that it has my full support, and I hope it has all of our full support.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Boy, the testimony and discussion today has provided yet another reminder of how critical childcare is to the health of our families, our health, and our economy. And I especially want to thank you, Chair Pinto, for being such a leader in this area and always pushing to keep these issues at the forefront and for bringing these absolutely necessary supports forward. Thanks also to Commissioner Bailey and Ms. Hoganson for their important work on the Children's Cabinet. And thanks especially to the testifiers who provided heartbreaking snapshots today of what they are experiencing during the pandemic and how our children, our families, and our economy depend on them. I hope that we all support these important initiatives going forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Are there other questions or comments from folks at all? We'll give a minute here to see if there are. And there may not be. In which case, we'll get things wrapped up. Just going to look one more moment here. Okay. Well, members, and certainly as I'm wrapping things up, if you think of something, Dave, please raise your hand. Let me know. But I guess I really do want to reemphasize Representative Pryor's comment that we really have shown, well, let me say this. I feel like we and our colleagues have actually heard a lot less about childcare over the past bunch of months than I might have expected, maybe at the beginning of the pandemic, knowing how this is going to be going. And I think that's exactly right. As Representative Pryor said, we moved collectively right away and got funds to providers and provided support to keep this sector going. It's been very challenging. Again, a lot of thanks are due to Commissioner Bailey and Ms. Hoganson and their team and the amazing team at DHS and many others who are working super hard I should note both Lori Pacine from DHS and Deb Swenson-Cladd have been on the call as well, in addition to Ms. Sommerfeld, and have been working just enormously hard over many months. The fact is, we've shown that when you take steps to support the sector, that works. We're in this situation now where after December 31, that goes away. And I suspect that come January, we will be hearing a lot about this sector and a lot of challenges. And then we certainly know, and Ms. Richardson's story was so powerful about the experience of low-income families. Again, if we've got somebody who's taking care of elders right now, we want to make sure they have childcare so they can be doing that work. I anticipate that a bill will be introduced in special session on Monday with these two proposals combined. And I really would welcome all members, certainly including the minority, the Republican minority, to reach out with questions, concerns, ideas. If you're ready to support, and the Representative Cortese Witteveen, I will call on you in just a second. If you're not ready to support the proposal right now, please let us know if there are changes, ideas, anything. This is going to really need to be an all hands on deck situation if we are to get this to pass and be able to provide support to be ready for next year. I really would like to do that. We've got a couple of other points though here. We've got Representative Cortese Witteveen, and I also know that DHS is ready to clarify the federal funding question. I think we may have lost Representative Heitzman, unfortunately. I may try to see if we can pull him back in. But in the meantime, Representative Cortese Witteveen, why don't we have you make your comment, and DHS folks, we probably will turn to you for that clarification as well. Representative Cortese Witteveen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did just want to chime in again and share with everybody, the fellow members on the committee and those watching, participating today, that this childcare issue by far has been the issue that I've received the most communication from my constituents on throughout the last 9 months of this pandemic. And it's just something that's impacting each of our communities, every corner of the state. I think that the work that we are doing in this committee is so important, and it's touching on, not only the families and the childcare providers themselves, but as Ms. Jaquith and others have noted, childcare is the backbone of our economy. So parents aren't able to find high quality support and care for their children, then, the rest of everything kind of falls apart a little bit as well. While we've been sitting on this hearing today, I received a text message, a phone call from the nurse, and a email from my daughter's four-year-old preschool program, letting me know about a positive COVID case in her class. And so, I think, it's unfortunately becoming the reality that eventually every one of us is going to be impacted on some level by this virus in very close proximity to those that we care for and those that we love. So I think that we just have to do everything that we can to support these families and our childcare providers. And I just appreciate you and the work that DHS and everyone has done in order to elevate this challenge as we come closer to the end of the year here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cortese Witteveen. And I do, members, I don't want to extend things too long, but as long as we're on the record, I'd like to get but we have folks who can answer Representative Heitzman's question earlier about federal funding. I believe he's coming back on. It sounds like there's staff from DHS who can answer that question. And so if we can have whoever that is, yes, and Representative Heitzman, we do have back. I think you just had to step away for a couple minutes. If we can have whoever that is at DHS who can answer that, identify yourself, and please let us know. And if you need the question repeated too, we can do that. And actually, maybe that's not a bad idea since it's been a little while, at least when you answer the question, if you can just remind us about what you're answering. I guess we've got Representative Heinzman. Why don't you ask your question again, if you can? It looks like you're the one who's unmuted, and then our DHS staff or whoever that is can do that. Please, yeah.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering what might need to be done to make sure that if federal funds do become available, that both of the proposals that we've heard today could potentially be reimbursed those costs back to the general fund. We're facing such a challenge in the next biennium with a significant deficit, and I'm just wanting to confirm that if there is something that needs to be done to change the language, can that or has that been done?
Thank you, Representative Heitzman. So whoever is able to answer that, if you could unmute and identify yourself and answer that. Not sure who that person is. At least I was told there was somebody.
Mr. Chair,
Chair, Representative Heinzman, I can answer, though, DHS staff confirmed this, that there would need to be language in the bill, and we would need to ensure that whatever is passed federally, you know, didn't have any restrictions that would limit us from using the funds or any considerations around supplanting federal funds. So I think we're open to including language in the bill, and then would just have to ensure that it complies with whatever is passed federally. And if I missed anything and there's DHS staff on the line that want to fill in, please do.
Let's first see if there's anything from the DHS staff to clarify anything that Ms. Hoganson said, and then we'll go back to Rep. Heinzman just to see if there's any follow-up there. And DHS staff, anybody have anything to add? I suspect the answer is going to be no. Well, Ms. Sommerfeld.
Yeah, no, Jennifer Sommerfeld, Legislative Director for Children and Family Services. Stephanie's testimony was correct, and we did confirm that. Thank you.
Okay, good, thanks. Representative Heisman, any follow-up from you on that then?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would implore all those that are involved in the final agreement and negotiations on this that language would be included.
Thank you, Representative Heinzman. Yeah, and a reminder again to us all that for this to move, because I don't want members of the public to get the wrong impression that then this is sort of a done deal, that for this to move really is going to take all of us really pushing for this to happen. And then as it does, let's definitely keep an eye on Representative Heinzman's point about federal reimbursement. I really would encourage members of the public that if you have input regarding these proposals, certainly contact your own members of the legislature to share whatever input you may have. Et cetera. And as long as I was giving shout outs to the DHS staff that's been working so hard, I do want to note Cindy Yang is on as well. She's the director of Children and Family Services, so oversees all of this work. And she and her team have been working just enormously hard. With that, I figure that was plenty of time for any further questions or comments. I'm not seeing any. And I just want to note that I anticipate that this is finally the final meeting of this early childhood committee. I think that we had expected that it would be there'd be an earlier final meeting, but here we are. And so just really want to thank members once again for for all of your work and dedication, and to our just incredible staff. Let's continue to do all we can to push the welfare of young kids and their families forward. So thanks so much. And we'll look forward to seeing folks at the next special session on a Monday afternoon. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.